Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Vig and Juice. It's been a while since we've done one of these, but we've got a lot to talk about. I'm really excited to kick off what's going to be a little mini-series, Blake, within our whole Vig and Juice series. You ready for this?
I'm ready.
All right. Well, it's been a little while since we did one of these, so let's just talk about the sports betting landscape in general. When we started these things, we were really talking about the fantasy sports landscape. Now we're just mostly talking about the sports betting landscape. So where is sports betting today in America? How many states are legal? How many states are still considering it? And then really, I think what's interesting is what's going on in Texas.
For sure. So I think last time we discussed this, there were 12 states that had not yet legalized sports betting, Texas being one of them. And now we're standing at 11, with Missouri being the most recent state to legalize sports wagering. That being said, there's a little bit of a holdup in Missouri, and the state didn't approve some emergency rules to get things kicked off. And basically, there's a bit of a delay that they weren't expecting, but they are setting a hard start date by December 1st of 2025, I believe. So should be live and going before the end of the year in Missouri, but Texas is still one of those 11 states without sports wagering.
Oh, poor Texas. Before we get to Texas, let's talk about, Blake, the different laws. Are sports betting laws equal in every state?
No, definitely not. There's a variety of different ways states are doing this. For instance, you've got some states that say only certain entities are able to get licenses to offer sports betting or partner with a sports betting operator, like the state lottery or Indian tribes. You've got certain states that are only authorizing Indian tribes to offer sports wagering. But as we saw in Florida, they passed a law that went through federal court for many years and basically said that only Indian tribes could offer sports wagering, but that they could do it statewide as long as the server was on tribal land.
So now we're building data centers on tribal land solely to serve sports betting.
Correct. Smart, throughout the state. So that kind of had everyone up in arms, all the casinos, of course, and ultimately, the state who passed the law and the tribe ended up on top there. And so kind of rolling that out there, other states will say that only sports teams and state lottery can offer sports wagering. Other people will say that only a certain number of licenses will be issued. So it's different in every state. And I'd expect it to be.
Which states? Because I know some states are really expensive, really hard, but the taxes are really high. I believe New York. What's the tax rate in New York?
Man, I think that one, someone like 50%, something
right?
Like that, yeah.
Which states are the lowest barriers to entry? Colorado, maybe?
I would say, just from what I've heard, Colorado. I think that North Carolina might be fairly straightforward as well.
I like to call that free market. I generally think competition is better. The states have an interest in making it somewhat difficult because you don't want to make it easy for a bad actor to get in. So if there's a application fee, and you and I know there's mountains of paperwork. I mean, there's entire companies are dedicated to just helping companies go through a application process on a state-by-state basis for sports betting. Not only sports betting, but also fantasy sports, right? DFS. So we can understand why states have an interest in making sure that you're just not letting in every applicant. But on the other hand, some of the stuff in these large markets is so burdensome. And then it's also very protectionary. Like you talk about Florida, right? They're very protective of the incumbent tribal casinos. But then also some of these other states that only have a couple of skins, like I think Illinois was one of them. They call them skins or licenses, right? There's just only a few to give out, with the notion that you're going to keep the license, you're going to give it to a player in that state. So you can try, and if we're going to create wealth in the state through this operator revenue, then it's going to be paid out to people who are in Illinois. But then what you have is you have Illinois just going sub-licensing that license out to a FanDuel or a DraftKings so that they could be in those states, right?
Correct.
Okay, that's the sports betting landscape. And then in Texas, where our legislature only meets every 2 years and nothing got pushed in 2023, so we're coming up now. I think I saw someone had filed a new sports betting bill.
Yeah, the House filed two bills, one being the amendment to the Constitution and then one authorizing sports betting, and I believe casino gambling in the state as well. So that came out within the last couple of days.
Here's a Google alert that I just got. Texas sports bill has been introduced into the House. So yeah, so there it is, Blake. That's it. Is it going to get passed? I don't know. I mean, we don't have a direct line into representatives or the governor's office, but the rhetoric we're certainly hearing is it's going to be no.
Yeah, I mean, Kevin and I just got back from the FSGA conference in Vegas, which is the Fantasy Sports and Gaming Association, which our firm is very active with. And there's a lot of talk that this is not going to be going through by some major operators. That's on one hand. On the other, we've got the governor of Texas coming out supporting sports wagering in the state and saying that taking an actual stance on it, which I hadn't seen in the past. Ultimately, we still are going to have the same issue that we had last year, which is Dan Patrick. And so the question is, did he get enough heat for not even letting it hit the Senate floor last year to where he's not going to do it again? And we can actually see what the Senate would do, or is he going to veto it again?
Yeah. So it really doesn't matter what Abbott says publicly, unless he's convincing Dan Patrick, who has this block as lieutenant governor on the Senate floor.
Correct.
So really interesting. We don't expect anything to happen in Texas, at least in 2025, which means it gets pushed to 2027. Presumably, we will have similar leadership in place in 2027. So we'll see what happens at that point in time. Let's talk for a sec about DFS. A year or two ago, Blake, DFS was moving very quickly. People were coming out with new creative games, and then states were taking positions on those games. A lot of states wanted to get out and regulate DFS. We've really seen a slowdown in state fantasy sport regulation. DFS is a subsect of fantasy sports. It's definitely the largest one. But why have we seen a slowdown in new fantasy sports legislation on a state-by-state basis? And then what are the current trends, Blake, with respect to DFS or some of these more creative pick'em style contests?
I'll answer the second question first about the pick'em contests. And that's where we've seen the most action or activity in the last couple of years. And initially, it was regulators catching on to these pick'em style contests and saying, no, this is not fantasy sports. It's sports wagering under our sports wagering law, because sports wagering laws were being passed with definitions that arguably included pick'em style contests that people were passing as fantasy for many years. And it made more sense for the regulators to bring those in to their sports wagering, because that's where they're going to make more money. And so a lot of pushback against those types of games. And we saw many of the major operators from those games fight it initially, and then ultimately put out a new product that was multiplayer. And so same product, but playing against other players instead of the house. And so that is what we've kind of seen take over the pick'em space, I would say, for the majority of states. We've still got unregulated states where operators are offering the player versus the house pick'em style. But I think that that is where we're seeing the most activity in fantasy sports. Now, why I think that we're not seeing much activity in the legislature for fantasy sports in terms of bills being introduced and not prioritizing legalization of fantasy sports is because states have focused on sports wagering and they've focused on other areas of gaming and just kind of accepted that fantasy is in their state unless otherwise prohibited. I believe we mentioned this in a previous episode, but where we are seeing fantasy still show up in bills is in sports wagering bills. And so we'll see exclusions to the term sports wagering, and that will include fantasy sports or daily fantasy sports. So essentially saying this is not gambling and codified.
So that's a really important point, is that a lot of people think, well, maybe daily fantasy and these pick'em style games, which a lot of people like to call 2.0, DFS 2.0, are going to be fly under the radar. They'll continue to be legal because there's not fantasy specific legislation. But like you said, we're seeing a lot of sports betting language that sweeps up fantasy sports. So to the extent you're in a state that's considering new sports betting codes or statutes, and you have an opportunity to influence that or to work with a lobbyist there, you want to make sure that you're specifically carving out fantasy sports or your style of contest, because otherwise, if it's included, then you're not going to be subject to those regulations, those compliance, those taxes. It's just a total, you're essentially a sports betting operator at that point in time.
Yeah. And states have treated that a little bit differently in legislation as well, where we've seen states like Colorado go back and redefine fantasy sports to specifically exclude single player games and in a way almost push out these pick'em style contests unless some very, very specific boxes are checked. We've also seen states specifically carve a path to letting these games in. And so I think that states are dealing with it differently and it's causing a lot of industry confusion, but they're here until they're not.
Yeah. So let's get into this new mini series I want to do, Blake, for the next couple episodes. And that's discussing the new season of Against the Rules. So Against the Rules is a podcast by Michael Lewis, the famous author, where he really dives into a different area of American culture. It recently has been focused on sports. So last season, which would have been season 4 of Against the Rules, they released 10 episodes covering sports betting. So we listened to the series. We talked about it. It covers a lot of the topics that we talk about, that we work with on a daily basis. And so what I thought might be interesting to do, Blake, is not do an episode by episode review because it's not really a legal podcast. But I think in a chronological order, we can pick out legal topics or themes and then discuss them in depth. Maybe this will take us 3 or 4 episodes, maybe 5 or 6. I'm not sure. But for today, you and I have agreed that we listen to episodes 1 and 2. So I wanted to talk about a few of the themes from episodes 1 and 2. Sound good to you?
Sounds good.
All right. So first of all, in the first one where he just kind of introduces sports betting broadly, he meets this gentleman who's a professional gambler. And the professional gambler talks about how he started gambling in high school. I think the statute of limitations expired for both of us. So, Blake, did you do any sports betting in high school?
I did not do any sports betting in high school. I graduated at 15, though. So.
Oh, that's a humble brag right there. I would have dropped that in. All right. I did. I grew up in Arlington. I went to high school in Fort Worth. And the Fort Worth Star-Telegram every week, they would publish a pick'em, just an advertising pick'em. And you would send it in with a dollar, and you could pick up to 20 games. And if you got 3 out of 3 or 5 out of 5 right, you got something. And if you got all 20 right, you'd win $1 million or something. And you and I know how incredibly impossible that is to do. So everyone was entering into this contest, right? I think the minimum was you had to get maybe 5 games right to win. So your dollar would turn into, I think, $20 if you got 5 right. You and I know how difficult it is to get a 5-team parlay. The odds of that are definitely way worse than 1 in 20. So the Star-Telegram, I guess, was running an illegal operation now that I'm thinking about it. But we would do this in high school. Me and my buddies, we'd cut it out of the paper and bring it into school. And during history class, whatever, we'd be filling this out. We had this one teacher, Mr. North, who started as a substitute teacher. Then, of course, he just worked his way into a full-time position because, whatever, the other teachers don't come back. And he would routinely come in and just look at them with us, and we would just bet him directly, right? So first question is, if I'm betting him directly, he wasn't making odds or anything, he wasn't acting as a book, would we have a private place exemption under 47.02 of the Texas Penal Code?
Man, what's crazy is they don't have an age limit
right
on that.
Let's assume we were 18, first of all. I think we would if we were 18 or 21.
I mean, private place exemption. So yeah. Is that a private place?
I think so. I mean, I don't know. Maybe not. Well, this wasn't a public school.
Oh, okay.
So no one could walk
in. Okay. Okay. So you've got the private place. No one's making any money.
Profit off the, other than the participants.
Okay. I think that arguably it might be legal.
I think it was. Now, there might be age. And I don't know what the minimum age entry to a contract. We'd have to look at that. There might be some age.
Well,
statute.
You do have to be 18. It might not be a valid contract.
Right.
But
as far as it being legal. Now, he did come to me one time, and this was around the Super Bowl, and he said, why don't we just pink slip our cars for this? I drove a $3,000 85.
I'm sorry, the teacher said this?
Yeah. Well, this was Mr. North. He had a nicer car. I think Mr. North's been a...
Don't tell me he took your car.
No, he didn't. We didn't make the bet. We didn't make the bet because I didn't like the line on it. I don't know how serious he was being, but he definitely offered that.
That's
one
fun.
Time. So yeah, so pink slip the car just means we're just going to trade cars on it. Okay, so he talked about this. This gentleman in the first episode talked about how in high school, that's how he got started, mm-hmm. right? And then I think what was really interesting, I don't want to get too much into just a review of the podcast, but for a long time, he wasn't really gambling. He was just arbitrage. He talked about in the early 2000s.
I think he was like a runner.
Yeah, right? Yeah. He was running, but also he could go and get lines plus 7 on one side, minus 4 on the other.
Well, and he was using the car, like he was using the cards to go do it himself.
Yes,
too.
That's it. Yeah. That's it. So really, really fascinating. He ended up going to jail for a couple of nights and ended up pleading guilty to a felony. So we finally get to PASPA. So the PASPA was the Professional and Amateur Sports Protection Act. I want to really talk about this for a few minutes. So first of all, Michael Lewis does a beautiful job of setting this up and introducing Bill Bradley. And I don't know if this is really his favorite basketball player, but he talks about what a fan of Bill Bradley he was in the 60s and 70s when Bradley was coming up at Princeton and then Bradley was playing for the Knicks. And I think it was interesting that he purposely called out that Bradley would shoot 500 shots a day and would go home. And Bradley was just a perfectionist, and that Bill Bradley knew if he missed a shot, he knew exactly what he did wrong, right? His elbow was in the wrong place. His release was in the wrong place.
The hoop was too low.
Right. He told that really cool one about he kept missing shots in this one gym and then went and measured it, and the hoop was too low.
Yeah, after saying it was an inch and a half too low.
He said it was, and then they went and measured it. He was right. And that's why he was missing, right? Not because he would actually miss shots. So I thought that was really interesting. But Bill Bradley, his reasons for passing PASPA, the Professional and Amateur Sports Protection Act, 1992. I think the word protection there is what's so important, because he felt that there was a need, or he had a duty, to protect the purity of sports. You know, in his mind, sports should only be played for the joy of winning, the thrill of victory, or the agony of defeat. And there's a purity in there. And I will admit that having young children from about ages 9 to 14 or 15, you kind of see that. And that's really important. You know, below 8 or 9, it's a total S show. Like, right, what are they doing? And then they start to get into high school and college, and the motivations start to change a little bit. But you can see it. But at the professional level, let's talk about today. Do you think that exists today, Blake, that there's this professional purity or sanctity of sports?
Oh, I mean, I think that some people would like to think that there is an emphasis on that. I think that in terms of sports wagering, the concern and the emphasis has transitioned to protecting the integrity of the game. This is why in sports wagering laws, one of the ways that state laws will vary is some states allow betting on college sports and some states don't. I was just recently in Oregon, and I was betting on my phone through DraftKings and wanted to bet on college sports, and I couldn't bet on college sports. And so I was literally on the border of Washington, and I see that Washington does allow it. I was getting ready to drive across the border, like, which was going to take me about an hour to get there to bet on college sports. And then I started thinking about the laws, and I was like, wait a second, do they let you do it mobily? And I looked it up and you couldn't. And so I turned around and went back. But I mean, I think that you've got these.
So you were thinking you could just get across the border, get into the right geolocation.
Yes.
And place it. Versus having to go to a window.
Go all the way up to Seattle, yeah, and go to the Emerald Casino.
Right.
So turned around, went back, was like, oh, whatever. But that being said, the reason why these rules are in place in some states is because college athletes can be influenced easier. They don't have the $1 million contracts. Not all of them have the NIL deals that the other ones do. And I think NIL could play a role in making them not so easily influenced if they are making some money. But I mean, there have been 3 or 4 stories very recently of athletes being kicked off of teams for throwing games.
So, I mean, this is exactly what it was meant to protect against, right? If we didn't allow it, then it would be impossible for these athletes to do this other than in Nevada. Also, I think it's important to remind people that New Jersey got so mad, and New Jersey passed its own referendum, which kind of started the whole tidal wave of sports betting. New Jersey had a year after 1992 to pass its own sports betting laws. They just couldn't get its act together. Here's where I think the difference is. First of all, I think Bill Bradley, even in 92, probably had utopian view of what sports really is, because there was always point shaving scandals. If you really go back and look at the mob in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, there's lots of point shaving scandals back then. So I don't even think in 1992 that the general landscape in America had this same utopian, perfect view of sports. But now I just think it's totally changed. Sports is a business first, and it's sports second, which I'm okay with. I really am okay with it. It's a business first. I mean, look, players can move. And players should have the ability to move, right? Freedom of contract, and we're getting rid of non-competes pretty much across the entire United States. So players have the freedom to move, fine. What the Heat did in the 2011s, the early aughts with the super team, like they want to get together, so they really have the power. So this notion that we're going to try and do what, of course, our legend Dirk Nowitzki did and just try and win it with one team, or like Kobe stayed with one team forever, that just kind of goes away. I think people are okay with that. So that's the first point, is there's so much movement. Coaches, look at college coaches. How many college coaches walk into a living room, look at a young person's parents in the eyes and say, I am going to take care of your kid for the next 4 years, and I'm going to look after him, I'm going to be a second father to him, only to come around the next day and say, I'm leaving this college, so I'm taking a lot more money somewhere else. And sure, that's their choice to do that, but don't act like there's sanctity in sports. And now with college sports, with the transfer portal, people have a right to labor. Like, this is a free market. People want to work in wherever market they want to work. They want to get paid in another college. Completely fine. But let's not act like sports are pure, like the motivations. Everyone's doing it just to get better and just to win. I think some people are purely driven. But let's talk about LeBron James for a sec, because I don't know if anyone in our era is as driven to win as LeBron James is, right? And he's on his fourth team, right? Cavs, Heat, Cavs, Lakers. And so he's leaving to take better contracts, or maybe to try and win with another team, but the contracts just went up every time. He left Cleveland the first time because he didn't think Cleveland could win.
Fun fact, I actually saw him in the Bahamas right after he left, because he was getting out of town.
Yeah, he had to get out of town, right?
And we were at the restaurant Great Cliff, and our host comes over and was like, do you want to meet LeBron James?
Yeah.
Walks us down to the wine cellar, and LeBron and his, I think it was his girlfriend at the time, and a bunch of his buddies were down in the wine cellar, just in sweats, eating. He had to get out of Cleveland.
Yeah, of course. Of course. So I think the landscape is fine. I think PASPA, whatever purpose it meant to serve, no longer had a place in the United States. And some people, that might make them sad, or they might be nostalgic about how sports used to be interpreted here. I think this is just a new era, and people want to bet.
Well, and I think people were betting anyway, but they were doing it illegally. And I mean, you walk up to anyone between 21 and 40 in a bar and ask them for their local bookie, they're probably going to have five they can give you. And that's in Texas right now, where it's not legal. Like, yeah, that's going on. So I think that you have it going on anyway. Why not pass regulations to try and be able to, one, collect taxes on it, two, put safeties in place to be able to, hey, if you do have problem gambling, then we're going to be able to put money into this fund that's going to be able to help you. If you do have problems with gambling, you can limit yourself, but also just be able to regulate it and not have.
Well, you're getting your responsible gaming, which I want to talk quite a bit about.
And it's also kind of curbing the criminal activity that goes around it. If you've got a legal book that is offering sports betting, then you don't have to worry about people losing 30 grand that they can't lose, and then fearing that their bookie is going to come break their legs.
I don't want this point to linger, because we'll address it in later episodes. I do think there's a really dark side to sports betting. And given where sports betting is, the only way to solve that dark side is through awareness and regulation and best practices. And we'll talk about that down the road. But just as far as PASPA goes, I don't have any problem with the repeal of PASPA under the premises under which Bill Bradley got it passed, because I just don't think those premises exist anymore. I don't think that's really what America, I don't even know if that's what America wanted in 92, maybe so, but I don't think that's what America wanted now, right? And if we're going to be a democracy, then we should be letting, for the most part, people choose what they want.
For sure.
All right. Well, that's going to wrap up this episode of Vegan Juice. We'll put this in the show notes, but it'd be helpful if you listen to episodes 1 and 2 of season 4 of Against the Rules by Michael Lewis. There are 8 more episodes, which Blake and I are going to cover in the next month or two, probably in 3 or 4 more podcasts. If you've got any comments or questions, or if you listen to the series already and there's something you might want us to talk about, we'd be happy to address it. Just hit us up on social media and we'll take a look at that and we'll try and work it in. So appreciate you listening. We'll be here for the next one. Thanks, guys.
Thanks. The Veilawood podcasts are recorded with the help of Radio MD, based in Chicago, Illinois. You can find all of our podcasts on our website at veilawoodlaw.com/podcasts. For questions, comments, or suggestions, email us at podcast@veilawoodlaw.com.